Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Watt and I'm joined by my dad, John Watt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And we're really pleased to welcome a guest onto the show this week. That's Dr. Daniel Morn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
We're really excited to have you on the show to talk a little bit about mental health, that vast topic. You're a psychiatrist working in the NHS here in the UK. Do you want to kind of explain a little bit about more about what that means and what does your work look like? What does a normal day look like for you?
Yeah, so a psychiatrist is a medic of the mind. We are trained as physical health doctors. There are so many terms that begin with psych. There's psychologists, psychotherapists. A psychiatrist is the medical doctor, as opposed to psychologists or psychotherapists who might deliver talking therapy. My job is to meet people who might have mental health problems, really get a good understanding of what those difficulties are, and come to a diagnosis, something like a depressive episode or schizophrenia, bipolar, obsessive compulsive disorder. So to arrive at a diagnosis and then to move forward to consider treatment plans. And the main two types of treatment plans we have are, you know, ones that include medication and ones that include talking therapy. But there's all the holistic sides of things that we talk to with patients, which include anything from sorting out their money to housing and various other things that the patient might need. So my day looks, well, it's very varied. What can I say? Do you want to know about my clinics and how often I see patients? Or would you like to know, what kind of people I see?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of people do you see? What kind of people turn up in the office of a consultant psychiatrist?
Well, the largest number of people who the largest number of conditions are depressive and anxious conditions, but most of them are managed in primary care. Us psychiatrists tend to see the really severe depressive episodes or the really severe anxiety episodes, the ones where they're unable to leave their room, is causing massive problems in functioning, and severe obsessive compulsive conditions. But a large mainstay, maybe around 50% of presentations, are maybe schizophrenia and bipolar. These are the kind of mainstay of psychiatrists, because these are the major mental illnesses that have long-term significant disability associated with it a lot of the time. I actually work in a psychosis service, so I'm the specialist psychiatrist for Oxfordshire dealing with psychosis.
And could you explain a bit more what psychosis is? I think most people have got a sort of vague idea, but how would you describe it?
The common perception of psychosis, and it's not helped by the name, it means split mind or detached from reality, and schizophrenia means split mind. So lots of people think that it's a Jekyll and Hyde type of picture. It's not really. What psychosis means is that you can believe things or experience things which aren't real. So believing things which aren't real might be you're being followed, or there's people out to get you, or maybe you know you've got a belief that maybe the aliens have landed, or you know something like that, which is really bizarre. The experiencing things which aren't real might be something like voices. So I'm hearing a voice. I think my neighbors are speaking about me. So delusions and hallucinations are what we call them, technically.
And you're a Christian as well as a doctor. Do you feel like your Christianity, your faith, plays much of a role in either how you got to this place or how you do your job as a psychiatrist?
So Jesus talks about having a heart for the poor, didn't he? And I think that one of the things about working as a psychiatrist is that I really meet those people who are having a really difficult time in their lives. And it is, I say, a great privilege to have access and opportunity to these people who are really struggling, to show them that they are valued, to show them that I respect them, to show them that I care for them in a deep and meaningful way. And I like to think that that is how I show Jesus's love to them. I think we have to be really careful about a power dynamic in mental health, because here are people who often are struggling to have a sense of reality. They're struggling with existential questions a lot of the time. And I very much see my role as a diagnostician and a caring, supporting doctor. And I'm careful actually about how much I talk about myself in any way, whether about faith or personally. Freud talks about, you know, the importance about being a blank wall, so that you can, the patients can bounce off you more easily. And there's a lot to be said about that. So I do try to keep myself a bit more private for good reason, therapeutically, and to be careful of the power dynamic.
I have a special interest in this, not just because, you know, interested in medicine and ethics, but also from my personal experience of being a psychiatric inpatient and of being on the receiving end of psychiatric care. And certainly, you know, from the patient's point of view, you know, what you said rings a lot of bells, that there is this huge power dynamic. You feel as a patient incredibly vulnerable, powerless, and utterly dependent on how you are being treated. But positively, you know, I am so grateful for the skilled, compassionate, thoughtful input I received from psychiatrists who genuinely cared for me, and who, you know, so I can absolutely see what a wonderful privilege it is to be in that position, as well as at times it must be incredibly difficult.
It's funny, it is difficult, because you have access to really painful stories, but I do think there is an ability to really empathize and understand without necessarily getting emotionally involved. And actually, there's a lot to be said for, you don't want your psychiatrist weeping with you. You want your psychiatrist to be caring but professional, understanding but not directly emotionally affected. So I think there's a lot to be said for reaching in and understanding the difficulty, but not, you know, feeling it like, you know, you would if you were a relative or a good friend, for example. And that is something that you do have to learn. And I do remember some of my first patients, perhaps I hadn't developed that professional demeanor, and I really did get very much involved emotionally. It really was a new thing for me. So I remember those very vividly. But, you know, you cannot continue like that. Otherwise, yes, you know, your resilience would be very poor indeed.
Yeah, no, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I've wrestled with exactly the same kind of issues as a Christian paediatrician, you know, on the one hand, wanting to empathize and to weep with those who weep. And yet at the same time, as you say, you need to retain some kind of professional boundary, precisely so that you can be trusted and leaned upon by the patients and so on. So it's a fascinating challenge, I think, too, because the opposite is also quite damaging, isn't it? When people are just totally cold and professional, it can come across as hurtful, that people don't really care.
That's right. I think there's a lot to be said for trying to find new ways of expressing people's difficulty that they haven't managed to access before, that can help reshape their understanding of a problem. Sometimes that means putting it into a diagnosis. Sometimes that might mean understanding it in a non-judgmental way, or a way that allows them to see a way through the problem. And that can often be a really therapeutic, caring thing to do. For example, you know, talking about a problem like a journey. And often it might mean saying to them, I can see hope here. You might not see hope, but I know I've managed people through this. and let me hold your hope for you. Of course, I do work with people who are I section as well and take into hospital against their will. And that carries another whole dynamic of a relationship. But actually, largely, most of the time, there is a sense that we can reconnect after that period of illness. And they can see that that really was necessary at the time. And I did have their best interests at heart. That happens the vast majority of the time.
One of the narratives we hear quite a lot around mental health care services is that they're incredibly overstretched, underfunded, the waiting lists are incredibly long, and that's been putting under even greater pressure in recent years since the COVID pandemic. Is that your experience, Daniel?
Absolutely. Psychosis rates have gone up. Child and adolescent presentations across the board have gone up. We're seeing that in adult services too. So yeah, absolutely. There's a sense that the COVID pandemic has sort of accelerated this sense of sort of disconnect in communities, and the sense of engaging with a virtual world almost exclusively sometimes with some people. And we know with mental health, it's so important. We are relational creatures, and it's so important to relate to other people, to be known and understood and by others, and to be in relationship. So this sense of the COVID pandemic has shut doors. It has closed people off to the outside world, and it's increased anxiety generally. Particularly cases like anxiety and agoraphobia are particular cases that have been triggered by the COVID pandemic. Goodness me, that was a lot to be anxious about in COVID, wasn't there? And it has been a real trigger for some people.
Do you think this is going to be a kind of a blip? And if when we kind of zoom out in a kind of 10, 20 year timeline, things will return to normal, whatever normal was? Or do you think this is going to kind of be a longer lasting shift in kind of society-wide epidemiology around mental health?
There's really good evidence that some conditions are pretty stable across populations and across time. So schizophrenia and bipolar are pretty stable. The more genetic conditions, these are, and so that would make sense, wouldn't it? But you look at depression, anxiety, these are the ones that have really risen. And I think if you look at our society, what COVID has done, and I think we are becoming more disconnected. We're existing more in virtual realms. And I think I struggle to see that going away anytime soon. So for that reason, you know, I do think we might not see the same acceleration, but I don't think we're going to see an ebbing of referral rates.
To Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And what's your perspective about social media? I mean, it's a topic we've talked about on previous podcasts, but as a psychiatrist, I'd be really interested, is it just the argument, of course, goes that we can have really meaningful relationships using the internet, using all the different tools that are there. You know, why do we need to be meeting people face to face in a physical world? And so what's your take on it as a psychiatrist?
I think it's damaging. I think it's damaging because we are forcing young people to be available to the external world 24/7. Young people are engaging with potential bullies and, you know, at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. at night, they are being forced and, you know, to project themselves in as an identity that apparently should be fully formed. They need to know what they're into, what they're against. You know, teenagers often, you know, are trying to find who they are, and social media puts that pressure to say, you know, tell us now. And it's a kind of realm where it's very easy to be torn down. It's so easy to put a jibe in. It's so easy to be negative and to not like somebody. or unfriend somebody, whatever the terms are. And so it's quite a brutal place. And I certainly see in my practice that there are so many casualties of social media, not only because of just the sheer amount of time that they're open and tuned into this world, which I think is unhelpful, but also because of the trauma of being bullied, you know, social media bullying. There's also one thing that I've written about, and when I see psychosis and bipolar, when they might be psychotic, they might be putting all sorts of stuff on social media that doesn't make sense, you know, saying about the MI5 following them or talking in a perhaps disinhibited way. And that's really damaging as well. And I've actually known somebody who had to actually unfriend, you know, create a whole new social media account and leave and to move to a new city because of the problems that happen through the social media account when they're unwell. That's devastating. I would say generally it's damaging.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? It's often said that, you know, everybody else forgets, but Google never forgets. You know, it's always there. And I can totally see that. I've never thought of that before, but it makes complete sense that if, you know, if I was losing the plot and then putting this whole lot of stuff out there for everybody to see, you can completely wreck any kind of relationships and trust and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And it's really hard to repair as well. It's not as if you can just go and see everyone. You know, you might have hundreds of friends. What do you do? And then everything becomes, you know, what do you make a big thing of it and fess up and say, I've got this problem? Well, that's a bit unfair on that person, isn't it? So, yeah, we often, well, I take a digital history off my patients now.
I do. I like it.
Yeah, I do. what do you do on the internet? What sites do you go to? Because let's not forget, you know, gambling is a massive thing, as is porn, and, you know, gaming as well. These massive multiplayer games, they are so addictive, and they are, I think, robbing people of the ability to form communications. One of the things I say about texting is that texting is kind of it slowly erodes the wonderful thing about face-to-face communications. And I think gaming is one step further away. And there's something that's very special, that's very spiritual about meeting another person in the flesh, that's meaningful, where you present all of you to be accepted. Okay, yes, it can be scary at times, but actually there's something healing there too, and good for our mental well-being that we're just losing the sheer amount of time we're spending on the internet.
Is there a case for kind of preemptively winding down your online presence, even if you haven't actually experienced any mental health problems? It's not just for those who are experiencing psychosis, but actually for the rest of us, is there a case that we need to be kind of better managing
Tim's getting
our
worried,
digital world?
He's clearly getting worried about this, you know. He needs a psychiatrist.
Speaking as a Twitter addict.
It depends at what cost. Are you getting those meaningful relationships? Are you having good conversations? Are you developing relationships in the real world? Are you ensuring that you are caring for people as well as being cared for in the real world? If that's the case, then that's fine. But if it's coming at a cost, then I'd really look at that hard.
Interesting. One of the other things I was really keen to ask you for your take on is, I've been seeing some recent kind of research and news coverage around the question of medication in mental health world, which is often a kind of contentious question among the kind of different treatment plans, is going down a kind of meditation route. And there was a fascinating piece I read in The Economist recently, which was kind of rounding up some of the recent research around antidepressants and kind of suggesting that actually in many ways, the kind of, if you look at studies in the whole, there's good evidence that actually they're little better than placebo for some kind of more minor conditions. Have you been following that debate? Do you have a perspective? How much do you prescribe antidepressants for kind of more minor conditions?
The minor conditions don't get to psychiatrists. They're managed by the GP. We deal with severe cases that, you know, so I'm not blaming my GP colleagues. I think they do an absolutely fantastic job in very difficult circumstances, but they're the ones who see the mild cases, and often they don't have other alternative options other than the medication. We do have social prescribing now, which I really do support. But look, antidepressants work. Ain't no doubt about it. If you look at the numbers needed to treat compared to other medications like blood pressure pills and things like that, we are up there being, you know, not far off effectiveness levels of antibiotics and other very reliable medications. They work, no doubt about it. But you look at mild depression, and there's a question whether this is an illness, the mild depression. Is it an illness, or is it a sort of a period of sadness where people are struggling? Certainly moderate and severe depressive episodes are respond very well to antidepressants. Mild cases of depression, anxiety don't respond. And actually the evidence says you don't use antidepressants in mild cases. What you should use is behavioral activation. What that means is doing more, seeing more people, exercising, getting your sleep in order, cutting down alcohol, these sorts of things. So for mild cases, no, they don't work. And we've got to be careful here because there is both overtreatment and undertreatment. These are not mutually exclusive things. Overtreatment happens and undertreatment happens. So when I talk about this, I say there are people out there who should be on antidepressants who aren't. And they are maybe the moderate severe end. There are other people who've gone to their GP with a mild depression who perhaps, you know, they've tried an antidepressant, it hasn't really been that effective, and they could have tried something else as well. It's not necessarily wrong, but sometimes if somebody's a bit depressed, the GP's been a bit quick to the medication, they haven't found it that effective, it might be that they should just try other things. It's not that antidepressants aren't effective. And certainly, you know, you look at, they're lifesavers. I think I regularly see them saving lives. So I'm a big fan.
Do you understand why some people feel wary about starting a course of medication? I don't know. I feel like there's a culture in which, like, either it's an admission of weakness or there's a fear that once you're on them, you'll never get off them. Do you come across that among any of your patients?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a lot of stigma attached to mental health problems, and I try to be patient when I come across it because I do get frustrated about the amount of stigma. I say, we mustn't stigmatize these conditions. The brain is an organ like anything else. If the liver doesn't function very well, we should take something to help the liver, and we should do the same with the brain. Just because our mind thinks using the brain doesn't make it any more or less prone to having biological problems with it. We can get it. There's a confusion and a category error there. I think that we can help ourselves with things like depression, but goodness me, we can help ourselves with things like diabetes and things like liver conditions. You know, a diabetic can exercise more and lose weight and have a healthier diet and improve their diabetes. Doesn't mean they should stop having the diabetes meds, though, does it?
Maybe there's a case for those, particularly in maybe church leaders and stuff, to be a bit more open about kind of, you know, wearing their own mental health conditions on their sleeves so that it helps destigmatize it. Certainly in Christian communities, that if you see that your vicar or your pastor is casually dropping into conversation or in a sermon when they saw their psychiatrist or when they, you know, picked up their medication, does that help? Is that a bit of a naive approach? Is that more complicated than that?
Oh, no, I think the more vulnerability we have in the pulpit, the better, and the more look what Stephen Fry did in the UK with bipolar disorder. He was really honest about his struggles there, and then actually we had a whole wave of people saying I've got bipolar. Well, actually not all of them did, but actually it was great because suddenly the stigmatized problem became something that people wore as a bit of a badge of honor because they were likened to the struggles that Stephen Fry had. And so I think there's a lot to be said for destigmatizing mental illness still. I would say that we've got to be careful about how we destigmatize mental health problems as well, because in our quest to destigmatize, we've come a long way. But in doing so, we've over-egged the medical model. And what we've done is we've said it's all illness. And I think we've disempowered people in doing that. So we've got to keep the narrative up that people have responsibility. They shouldn't be blaming themselves. But there's this sense that just because it's you know, we need to be careful about how we talk about it. So it's not that every vicar should just fess up, because sometimes that can be damaging. We need to be nuanced about our message.
Yeah, there is this very strong tendency, isn't it, in the modern world to over-medicalize things. You know, death and dying has become very medicalized. And I think mental health is another area, isn't it? So whenever I'm having any kind of struggle or finding life difficult, I say, oh, I've got this mental health issue at the moment, and I need treatment. What's your response to that?
I think you're right, John. I think we do over pathologize, and you know, nobody's sad anymore. They're always depressed. Mm. I mean, anxiousness is a anxiety is a normal term we use, but they're just anxiety disorders. The thing that I talk about, which is quite interesting to think, is doctors generally have used Greek terms for conditions. So you look at the term rosacea. Rosacea just means red face. But the patient goes to the doctor and says, I've got a red face. And the GP goes, or the doctor says, you've got rosacea. But what the GP has done is they've diagnosed a specific type of red face. The problem we've got in mental health is the patient comes on and goes, I've got depression. And the doctor says, oh, maybe you've got depression then. So it's confused, because there's no sense of difference between the common parlance of emotional variability and a medical illness. And I think from that comes a lot of problems in both people feeling confused about what depression actually means, which is a much wider syndrome than just sadness, interestingly. But it can also do discredit to the people who are actually fully clinically severely depressed, thinking, oh, maybe I'm just the same as these other guys. I'm just not coping quite as well. No, you've got a really serious condition that's really, you know, severe and needs medical treatment. And it's not the same as these other people.
Hmm. That's really interesting. And maybe if we were more medically literate, we would be able to differentiate between I have anxiety and I have generalized anxiety disorder, which is, you know, in the DSM and has a list of criteria, and is they might have the same word in them, but they're, as you're saying, they're actually quite different. They're experienced very differently.
And the way to go about thinking about this is, you know, have you done everything you can to try and help yourself? You know, have you cut down alcohol? Have you got your sleeping in order, or can't you get your sleep in order? You know, are you using all of these self-help techniques that we know of? You know, are we talking about our problems? And if none of that is working and you're still really struggling to function in a reasonable way, then that's the time to look for help, because you've sort of looked through all your strategies. So the GP shouldn't necessarily be the last, but it certainly shouldn't be the first port of call to look for help. And my concern is probably that we're reaching for it first, when actually there's a lot of I think primary care, we talk about primary care being GPs. Primary care should be us helping ourselves. Hmm. Secondary care should be our friends and family helping us. And then perhaps GPs are tertiary care. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I wonder whether there's a role for the church in kind of pushing back on that overcorrection and that tendency we have as society to kind of over-diagnose, over-medicalize. That's something I'd love to hear Daniel's take on next week when we kind of resume our conversation on mental health in the church. So do follow us, come back for that. But we've run out of time for today, so I'll have to draw it to a close. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for being here. As always, you can find some more stuff to read and stimulate your own thinking on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But do join us next week. We're going to be picking up again with Daniel Morn talking about mental health.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.